So I'd like to introduce our next session, the Circular Economy Ministerial Advisory Group, which was actually launched at Circularity 2 years ago. So it's great to have this group here again today. This session will provide an overview of the advice of the advisory group to the government, and the presenters are going to share some insights into evolving strategies, the collaborative efforts that are happening across Australia, and importantly, trends in business, sharing with us the barriers and some opportunities, and also what they're recommending to government. So we've got that inside track. Please welcome to the stage our panel, who will be moderated by John Thwaites, Paul Klimenko, Larry Marshall, and Dominic Hez. Please.
Well, thank you very much, Maria, for that introduction. And I'm really pleased to be sitting here with my colleagues from the Circular Economy Ministerial Advisory Group, Paul Klimenko, who I'm sure everyone here knows, co-founded Australian Ethical in 1987, has been working in this space for too many years. And of course, co-founded Planet Ark in 1992 and has been on the Circular Economy Ministerial Advisory Group. Then Dr. Dominic Hess, who is an author, educator, policy advisor, board director, chair of Green Fleet, and is going to focus today on, I think, some of the building side where you, Dom, have had a lot of experience, as well as water and other areas. And then down the end, the guru of innovation, Dr. Larry Marshall, chair of Fortescue Innovation, director of ASX, was the longest serving CEO of CSIRO and really built CSIRO, who are such an important player in the circularity space, I've got to say. And Larry, it's fantastic to have you here as well. So as Maria said, it was 2 years ago at Circularity 2022 that Minister Tanya Plibersek announced a Circular Economy Ministerial Advisory Group. And I was appointed chair shortly after that, and we set up the Circular Economy Group. I think there's about 12 of us from industry, people who have had a lot of experience in the circular economy. And we've been working together now for the last 18, 19 months, producing advice to the government. And today, what I hope to do is to provide an update of where we're at, and also to hear directly from some of the members on some of the core areas that we're focusing on. So just to get started in terms of our work, we were tasked with identifying the key opportunities for the circular economy in Australia. And we did that, and I might say we relied very much on the work that the CSIRO has done in doing that. And we divided up our work to really focus on those different sectors. And they are mining, of course, incredibly important for the Australian economy, but huge opportunities for circularity, construction, our building sector, and importantly, infrastructure, roads and bridges, etc. Manufacturing, and plastics have obviously been a focus, but the manufacturing area, agriculture and food waste, and resource recovery in waste streams. We also, following, I might say, some pretty strong advocacy from the water sector, focused on water too and the opportunities in water. And as we've looked at each of those sectors, we've looked at a number of crossover issues like the impact on net zero and how the circular economy can really contribute to that. Innovation and skills, how we need that innovation and skills. And very importantly, looking at the circular economy as an economic lever, something that can provide real economic opportunities for Australia. Overarching all of that has been the importance of recognising the role of First Peoples, First Nations in Australia. And Professor Robin Quiggin has led that work in our Ministerial Advisory Group. And we think there are really unique opportunities in Australia to learn from our first peoples who've been caring for country for tens of thousands of years, using a lot of circular economy type of principles. So what have we done? Well, earlier this year, we released an interim report. And we partly did that because we don't want our work just to produce a big report that sits on the shelf. We're really keen for it to be an iterative process where we actually saw government doing things as a result of our work. And that's why we released that interim report. And the good news is that a number of our recommendations have already been adopted. The first was that there should be a Productivity Commission inquiry into the opportunities of the circular economy, and the government, Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, has agreed to that. And that is so important because, as many of you will know, if you're going to convince Treasury, who hold so many of the levers, if you're going to convince business, probably the best way to do that is to have a Productivity Commission report to identify the opportunities and barriers. The second core recommendation we made, which has already been adopted, is around government procurement. I mean, the Australian government purchases about $75 billion worth of goods every year. And that is a huge lever that can help create a market for circular economy products. And the government announced following our interim report that they would be implementing a environmentally sustainable procurement policy. And that's already in place with construction contracts, for example, over $7 million now, considering circularity. And from next year, it will also apply to IT and furniture contracts as well. So I think that's an important step. And the third key recommendation we made, which is being implemented, is that the circular economy shouldn't be seen as something out on the side. It should be embedded in all core government policies. And a good example of that is the National Reconstruction Fund, $18 billion, which can be invested in innovation and business, now has circularity as one of its criteria. But this also is applying across government and across government activities like critical minerals as well. So that's the interim report. I'm now going to just talk a bit before I pass over to my colleagues on our final report. And fair to say, we're right in the midst of the final writing of that. And we're in that stage where everyone is trying to design the wording by committee, which I'm going to have to start pushing back on. But having said that, I can't say all of our recommendations, but I can, I think, today in this room give a pretty fair idea of where we're going. The first core recommendation that we'll make, and we also made in the interim report, is that Australia needs a national circular economy policy or framework. We don't have one. 72 countries around the world do. We don't. And that needs to set ambitious targets. I know from my experience in government, it's often targets that drive change. And we believe that that framework should have some ambitious targets, but also really set out what are the priorities and who's going to do what. And so that's our first recommendation. To accompany that, we need national circular economy legislation. Jana's talked about the two levers, which are essentially the market lever and the regulatory lever. In Australia, we need both, and the regulatory lever will, in fact, underpin the market lever to a large degree. So we're going to be recommending a national circular economy legislation. And importantly, I think we will point to the EU Eco-Design for Sustainable Products regulation as a blueprint for the sort of thing that we should have here in Australia. And that not only allows for product stewardship, it also enables the setting of standards that are going to drive the circular economy. Standards for products in things like repairability, reusability, the presence of dangerous chemicals. And we haven't had that in Australia. We've had a bit of a hodgepodge with some state regulation, bits and pieces of Commonwealth. What we need is a comprehensive national approach to that standard setting. So that's the second. The third thing that we've really heard from industry, though, is that we need to have a harmonised approach between the Commonwealth and the states. Industry have told us it's a real barrier when you have different rules in different states. And while we're still going to have some differences, we believe there's a real benefit if we could have a harmonisation, a bit like we have in building with the Australian Building Codes Board, that sets standards that different states can implement. Another core area, and I think Dom will talk a bit about this as well, is around place-based approaches to the circular economy. It really does lend itself to a place-based approach. I think many of you will be aware of the Bega Circular Economy Initiative, which is an example. It's also happening in other areas. And as Australia moves to things like hydrogen hubs or regional net zero industrial precincts, we need to embed the circular economy in that. And then the final really important issue, and I think Larry will talk more about this, is around innovation and research. And we'll be recommending a challenge-based funding approach to that, rather than just funding individual businesses or individual projects, really setting up Australia for achieving some of the big objectives or challenges for the circular economy. So that gives a bit of a flavour of what we're proposing. And now what I'd like to do is pass over to the panel and maybe ask you each, sort of setting this up as a general question. You've been on the panel for 2 years now. What was some of the most exciting and interesting reflections you've had in the areas that you're particularly focused on through this process? And if I can start with Larry, with your background in innovation.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, John. So for me, circularity is like a second chance at innovation for Australia. You know, we are last in the OECD for our ability to innovate. We're in the top 10 for our ability to invent and do research, but we're in the bottom for our ability to turn that into something that drives the economy or that solves a national challenge. But this is a second chance. So Australia invented the solar cell design that's made in China today, but we didn't back it. We didn't innovate it. We didn't turn it into what the Chinese did. We actually invented a third of the world's polymers because we invented the design platform called Raft, which enables polymers to be made. But again, we didn't commercialize them. But this is a second chance. Because we understand how they're made, we have a better chance than most at actually figuring out how to make them better, how to make them naturally recyclable. And the thing that's sort of historically been missing for us has been funding for this type of science project, you know, first to world commercialization. But we created a fund called Main Sequence Ventures, which funded a number of science-based startups like Ulu and Samsara, who have created polymers that are absolutely 100% recyclable. And they don't come from petrochemicals, they come from nature. So they're natural, fully circular from day one products, funded by Australian money and driven by Australian ingenuity and innovation. So for me, this is part of our second chance, a chance to kind of do the things that perhaps we should have done 20 or 30 years ago, but do them better. Because we created MSV, we also created Blackbird to try and plug this gap. Finally, big institutional investors like the superannuation funds and others are starting to step in with impact investing, a desire to actually have social good, public good coming out of financial returns. And that's a big shift for us, but it gives me great optimism that we will start to see a lot more of our brilliant inventions find their way across the valley of death and come out into this new market where everything is circular by design.
And Dom, you've really focused on buildings and food in the Circular Economy Ministerial Advisory Group. What excited you?
So my challenge is, how do I link the two, right? So what for me was the most interesting, exciting bit about being involved above the sectoral stuff is the harmonisation that we did, and that everyone came there with their expertise, but no, and their own agendas, I guess. But our process was, what are the pain points for industry? What are we trying to solve, and how do we solve it together? And I thought that was a really positive experience of solving the problem of what do we do with our waste. Now, I did come there with my building hat on. And so for me, the discussions around that and the need for national harmonisation is so important, and the fact that goes into our recommendations. But what's the biggest opportunity with our buildings? Well, most of the buildings we need for the next 30 years are already here. So how do we reuse buildings? And then if we're looking at reuse and we do need to knock the buildings down, how do we reuse the materials? And so having the standardisation and the specification so that it's not harder to reuse concrete than it is to buy new, I think is so critical for enabling that pain point to be solved for industry. And then for agriculture, you mentioned the place-based approaches. Bega was a great example where you have an industry, a sector within Bega that is willing to step up. And sometimes those regions just need somebody to broker the relationships between the funder and the people doing the work. You know, the farmers should be enabled to do their farming. They don't have time to fill out forms and get grants and so forth. So how do we enable that? And that role of the broker, whether it's for regions, farms, or whether that is for place-based. So what does that mean for an industrial precinct to be more circular? I think that is so exciting.
And Dom, you mentioned that role of the broker. That's certainly something that we learned through this process, that this will not happen unless there are people that are bringing the buyers and sellers together with a level of expertise, whether it's in the regions or in industry as well. Yeah. And Paul, what about you? What did you find exciting? You've been around so long, nothing would be exciting, is it?
No, lots of things, actually. And one of them is what Dom and yourself have just mentioned, is that the role of transition brokers, you know, in facilitating collaboration. And we like to think Planet Ark and the ASUB is one of those transition brokers. But one of the big aha moments for me was actually when the minister's advisor thanked us the other day. And he thanked us not only for our work, but also for raising the literacy level, the C literacy level amongst government. And I reflected on that and I thought to myself, I've been on other government committees, but I always feel like I'm just one of those silos that, part of one of the silos that Jana's referred to earlier this morning. But we had ministers come from virtually every area of government, and they came prepared to talk about the circular economy. They weren't just there to have a get a pitch from us. They actually were telling us what they were planning to do in their portfolios. And I thought, this is weird. I've never experienced this before in a government committee. And also the fact, the level of engagement, the fact that Minister Pibizek was basically in every meeting. I mean, I'm used to government committees where the minister comes in, thanks us at the, you know, first 10 minutes of a meeting. I'll see you in a couple of years' time and thank you at the end. And we had this incredible engagement, which, again, I think is the reason why we've managed to get some of these interim report recommendations through, like the integration in the NRF mandate into the net zero plans. They're all things that happen because we had a whole of government collaborative approach. That's how I saw it. But getting back to the role of transition brokers, I think they're absolutely going to be crucial because, as everyone knows, my old dad joke, there's a capital C in circular economy and there's a capital C in collaboration. You cannot achieve one without the other. And I that recognition amongst the group, amongst government, that we're going to need, you know, not just transition brokers, but very good transition brokers, because the quality of the transition broker will determine the speed of the transformation. So I think that's probably, I mean, I've got a whole bunch of other ones, but I think I've spoken enough.
And Paul, you highlighted the opportunity we had to meet direct with the ministers. I couldn't agree more. That was probably the most important factor. We had an afternoon with Jim Chalmers, and that, I think, then did lead to the Productivity Commission inquiry. If you look at the Measuring What Matters wellbeing index that the Commonwealth Treasury now has, it's now added circular economy indicators, material footprint. That was never there. As Yanis was saying, it's not part of the political discussion, and it certainly hasn't been in Australia, but it was put there. And we had meetings with Chris Bowen, with the agriculture minister, many others, and Ed Husic. And I think that made a huge difference. And I think it has also helped us move from just being an advisory group talking about issues to actual action. And that was the thing I'd like to ask you about now, how from your experience, what we need to do to go from discussion now to actual action, to decision-making, and to realise the opportunities. And maybe, Dom, starting with you, what do you see as the key things that should occur?
So I think part of it is just making it visible. So one of the figures that shocked me for the building industry is that we spend $1.4 billion to throw away $26 billion of materials, materials that are very usable. And if I translate that to the householder, if you're building a new house, that's $10,000 worth of materials that are coming to your house, sitting there, and maybe half a pallet of bricks goes, they don't need it anymore, goes to landfill. And I think there is great potential in that clarity around that. So, one of the other things that I think we were really talking about solutions by having industry come to our meetings. So when somebody comes to your meeting talking about water and brings biosolids, poo, turned into biochar, biochar is like little apartments that sit in the soil and hold water and nutrients and increase the effectiveness of your soil by a lot. And bringing those two things together is really enabling.
Yeah, and that biochar, I remember, sat on the table for the whole meeting, so it focused our attention. Paul, I
think the mobilisation of investment capital, which is obviously why we're getting our hands dirty with Boston Global and aiming to do that. But I remember at that finance meeting with Jim Chalmers, and we had the head of Australian Super, I think it was, or the CIO, I should say. And he was saying, we actually don't get circular economy investment approaches. And I thought to myself, that was a real shock. In fact, that was one of the reasons why we started talking to Boston Global, because I thought there's obviously a significant opportunity there. And obviously we're hoping to mobilize our funds from people like Australian Super, you know, in other words, acting as that aggregator. So I think the good thing is that there's definite appetite in that space, and that's really important, because you don't make these transformations without that investment. Whether we're investing in new facilities, new technologies that Larry mentioned, or you're providing the investment pool so you can have a sharing platform. I mean, you know, who's going to hold those assets that are going to be shared by the community, for example? So that's probably my number one. And the other one was really this need for systems thinking, and Jana's pointed it out in his presentation as well. If we don't think in systems and we just think in boxes or silos, we will often make mistakes. And so the one I love to highlight is, for example, we say we're not going to use plastic packaging for our food, you know, takeaway food. So we're going to go to fiber. And fiber is not really designed to be water and grease resistant. So what do? We add PFAS to it. And then when we want to compost it, or recycle it, but now we've got a chemical of concern, which is very hard to ever get rid of. And then we end up having a situation like in Queensland where they're saying, well, you're not going to be able to put your compost on land because it's got too high levels of PFAS. So again, we've got to think in systems. We've got to think, what's the most appropriate way if we're going to have a takeaway food delivered to our thing? What is the most appropriate system? Not just jump to another version of an environmental bad thing.
And Paul, you mentioned the super funds and investors. We did, in fact, have a number of stakeholder meetings with investors, including the super funds. And while there is appetite for this, because they see this as a general direction society has to undertake, they did say that the uncertainty about whether this was really, the circular economy was really going to be a thing in Australia, and whether it was going to be underpinned by clear national policy and regulation was a factor. And that's investing in things like major plastic recycling. They're not going to do that if there's not some certainty about the future. And that was the message we got from the investors. Larry, from your perspective.
Yeah, so as John mentioned, we've recommended a challenge-based approach, kind of like national missions, like they do in the US. And the reason for that is sort of going back to 2016, we faced exactly this question in CSIRO. We'd spent nearly 30 years studying climate. We had not ever reduced our own emissions in 100 years, but we were experts on what other people should do. CSIRO invented the raft platform that created a third of the world's polymers, but we had never eliminated single-use plastics in any one of our 55 sites. So clearly getting action out of brilliant people is difficult, and we had silos of excellence, as Dom mentioned. There wasn't much collaboration across the 55 sites. So the great thing about missions or challenges is it gives everyone a common goal. You paint a sort of a market vision of the future, where Australia could be if it only did these couple of things. And then you do a roadmap backwards from that end state, from that market vision back to today, and you figure out the steps that you need to go through. So we did that. And over a six-year period, we took CSIRO's emissions about 80% of the way to net zero, first emissions reduction in its history. That was critically important because at that time, every time I did a boardroom lunch, presentation to boards of big ASX 50 companies, they said, yes, but Larry, you know, lowering emissions means lowering profits. CSIRO delivered its first profit in 100 years at the same time as it lowered its emissions 80% of the way to net zero. So we had irrefutable proof for those boardrooms that no, you can have zero emissions and you can have increasing profits. We did a similar thing with circularity. So we actually, Australia has a national mission to end plastic waste. We're about 45% of the way there. So not quite halfway there. But when we started, we were 0% of the way there. So in the last sort of four and a half years, Australia as a country has made huge inroads in that. So this notion of harnessing our genius, breaking down the silos of excellence and focusing us on solving a few really big problems to deliver a profound change. In the resources industry, again, it's believed that sustainability is like a tax. It's like something that you have to deal with, but it's not necessarily an opportunity. And yet, we were able to reinvent the way gold is made. So this is green gold. This is sustainable gold. If you know how gold is produced, it uses a lot of cyanide and arsenic, and it's very damaging to the environment. So much so that in most places in the United States, you can't do gold production anymore. But not with this Australian invention, not with this Australian process technology, which actually makes gold not truly circular, but certainly far more sustainable and far more nature positive. And examples like this are the things that convince the big super funds, the big financial investors, that actually it is not just good for the planet, but also good for their investors, their members, who are you, by the way, because we all contribute. We're all paying the money to those funds to invest. We care about sustainability. We care about the planet. And they're able to do both. They're able to give us circularity, better nature positive outcomes, and still give us financial returns. That's the myth that we've been trying to break through innovation. That's Australia's big opportunity. As I said, our second chance at innovation to grow a different kind of economy powered by the fact that we're in the global top 10 for our science, for our ability to invent. We've just got to get better at turning those inventions into innovations.
Well, if anyone sees Larry's coat lying around, you know there's gold to be found therein. The theme of this conference is resource-efficient value chains. Can I ask, what have you learned in your time on the advisory group that can support resource efficiency to support the circular economy transition? Maybe starting with you, Paul.
I think the thing I learned, I had a reasonable idea that we were a fairly resource inefficient economy, but through the work that we commissioned with CSIRO, et cetera, I didn't realize how bad we were. And that was initially quite depressing because, you know, when you're in the bottom of OECD or either the highest material or the lowest for material productivity, you think, and I look around, and I see, you know, you look at council cleanups and you think, well, there's a physical manifestation of that wasteful society. But what I also see from the other side is that that gives us a lot of opportunity to improve. I mean, you know, when we're way, way away from being perfect. So this gives us the opportunity to become much more resource efficient. And I think also learn from Europe and other, like we're like adopting the sustainable design guidelines, because most of the environmental impact of a product or a service is determined at the design phase. And I know all the designers in the room are going to applaud me afterwards, but it is, you can't, it's very hard to have end of pipe solutions. We've got to find the root of the problem, as Jenna says, and actually solve from that perspective. So I think that systems thinking, design thinking is crucial. Whatever we're doing, whether it's building a new town or city, or building a industrial hub or whatever, to apply that systems thinking and understand where that system's going to fit in with the bigger picture system that we're all part of, being nature. So I think that's probably my number one tip, is think of how whenever we make a decision, whether it's at home, at work, or in government, what impact is that going to have in nature? And I always like to use this as an example. I'm a techno junkie. I love a new phone. I have to admit, this is the longest I've had a phone, believe it or not, in my life. It's 4 years old. I know that's a shameful thing for an environmentalist to admit, but that is 70 kilos of resources come out of nature. That's my body weight, basically, and yet it fits in my pocket. It's about 200 grams. So definitely, when this does end of life, we have to recover every resource out of this. We buy a concentrated nature to an nth degree here. And so what I'd love to see is when we have a labeling for product labeling, just for people to get an idea. I was shocked when I found that out, by the way. I had no idea. When I asked people to guess what that number is, most people guess, I don't know, 5 kilos, 10 kilos. No one has come anywhere near 70 kilos. And I've tried it with washing machines and a whole bunch of other household products. So us being able to actually get a label which says this is how much has come out of nature to provide this for you, which might make us be much, much more appreciative of nature, but also realize that we need to maintain these resources in our economy and not keep thinking we can just pull out more and more, you know, finite resources out of the earth's crust, or, you know, just clear more land to grow more biomass for our use.
But I think that's a great example. But the point Yanis made earlier about if you just focus on the end consumer, you're probably not going to get there, because it's the whole business system that's driving us to change over all of these electronics every 2 years or whatever, partly because all the connecting things don't work anymore.
So I'm ignoring all my Apple emails.
Yeah.
To upgrade.
Yeah.
But I'm going to get a new battery and recycle the battery.
All right. Just before I'll pass to Larry to talk more about resource efficiency, just to remind you, if you've got a question, put it on the app and we'll try to respond to those shortly. Larry.
So Australia today digs things out of the ground, commodities, without any real improvement, and puts them in a ship and sells them overseas. And then we buy them back as, you know, cars and televisions and washing machines, that sort of thing. And it's frustrated all of us for a long time. But we do the same thing with our ideas. We have a brilliant idea. We license it to some big US company who sells it back to us as, you know, medical device or whatever. But it's very rare that we actually say, wait a minute, can we add more value to these commodities here from the power of our minds? And circularity is an opportunity to change that. At the moment, because of geopolitical disruption, the United States is being forced to completely rethink their global supply chain. So there's an opportunity for Australia to jump into the semiconductor supply chain. As you mentioned, there's an opportunity to jump in there because the US, the biggest consumer of those chips, really doesn't want the risk associated with Taiwan or China producing them. Australia has incredible material science technology and this hunger to get a second chance at innovation. So I think we will see us creating better resource extraction, more sustainable resource extraction, but also adding value to the resources so that instead of selling a commodity, we sell something that's had value added to it. One of the great examples is, for example, instead of doing lithium mining, which is environmentally very unsound and challenging, there are ways to do lithium sustainably the same way we invented how to do sustainable gold.
if we do that, and with the additional step of actually upscaling the lithium to, say, a battery precursor, a hydroxide, or even an anode, we can ship maybe 1/100th of the mass, but still have way more profitability. So more sustainable, less carbon emissions from transport, using renewable energy to actually do that conversion. You can start to, if you think about it for not very long, you'll start to see we could earn our way to a whole new part of the global value chain. And if you have trouble imagining it, I actually wrote a book about it. So if you have trouble imagining it, there's a market vision in this book, which is basically what we use to turn Syro's 30-year decline into its first growth in 30 years and delivering its first profitability in 100 years. Now, I'm not saying that to brag, although I'm very proud of what Syro did, but it's to convince industry that sustainability is not a tax. It's an opportunity for growth. You can have great business outcomes and you have great environmental outcomes. They don't have to be competitors. They can actually be partners, but we've got to innovate. We've got to rely on our amazing science, top 10 in the world, our amazing science, so that we can take this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to rewrite the global value chain. I'm a bit passionate about this one, as you might be able to tell.
Well, go on.
So last year when I was at Circularity, I mentioned there's no waste in nature. And that's been the one thing that people are getting back to me. Oh, hadn't thought about that. But then, you know, we've been working with Professor Robin, and thinking about the First Nations role. Well, there was no waste then either. First Nations people had no waste. And so there is such an amazing conversation around looking at nature and looking at First Nations practices and saying, what can we learn from that? But for the value chain, the bit that excited me the most was that we weren't just talking about regulation and strategy and frameworks and policies and so forth. We were really thinking, how do we create an enabling environment? And how do we teach the whole value chain what circular economy is and what their role in the circular economy is and how we can all be part of the solution? And for me, that enabling environment is what will make the difference, because we can write regulations, we can write policies, but if people don't feel like they can step up and thrive because of what we're doing, then there's just going to be resentment. Whereas now it's going to feel very enabled and possible, whether economically or through knowledge or through labeling or through harmonization across states and federally. So that for me is exciting.
Great. Thanks, Don. Well, it's now an opportunity for some questions from you, and you can do that through the app. And I do have some questions, so I'm going to start with these. I'll ask Larry perhaps first. You talked about that challenge-based funding. How do you enact a challenge-based approach to research and innovation? How do you actually get it started?
Yeah, so Mariana Mazzucato came to Australia a couple of times to tell about how they did it. We did it the opposite way, and we didn't listen to Mariana. So we kind of invented our own Australian version of missions. And the difference really is in Europe, the European Union put about 3 billion euros into a national missions program, and that's all taxpayer money, all government money. The national missions that we have in Australia are the opposite, in that about 90% of that money actually comes from Australian or US industry. And that was really the trick. But the reason it was so important to do it that way was to convince industry that actually sustainability could be financially beneficial, could be profitable, not a tax. Whereas if we'd done it the European missions way, it would have just been government money and we wouldn't have moved industry. Syro built about half a dozen of these national missions. One of them I mentioned, the ending plastic waste, about 45% of the way to completion. The net zero one is by far the hardest. But because we created this sort of opposite way of funding missions, using industry to actually pay for them, the US invited Australia into their national mission for net zero because they hadn't seen what Australia had done anywhere else in the world. And so we've had a profound impact as a country on a number of sort of global national missions program. the big one for me next is how do we make circularity a national mission, and which specific companies and funds can we get to step up? I'll give you a hint. If anyone saw Ken Henry, the former chairman of NAB, on the panel about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago here in Sydney around sustainability, that bank and CommBank hugely leaning into this area. So I think we'll see some movement from them financially to support this. But they're not the only ones. So there's definitely been a change in the financial institutions in Australia to actually see this as an opportunity, not a threat. And that's a huge change.
Thanks, Larry. Well, the top question now, and I must say this just emphasises why compliance is important and regulation is important, is how do you see mandatory climate-related financial reporting affecting circular economy in Australia? And I'm happy to have a go at that. First thing to say is from next year, large companies will be subject to the regime of mandatory climate-related financial reporting. That, as I understand it, does not specifically cover circular economy or circular economy issues, although they are closely related, because in analysing your climate risks and your transition plan, your credible transition plan towards net zero or your climate targets, the circular economy could well be a key component of that. And I would expect that for a number of companies, they will be looking at circular economy measures as part of their transition. Having said that, under the international sustainable finance rules, the circular economy is a specific consideration. And in the first iteration of mandatory reporting, as I understand, that's voluntary for companies in Australia. And they will be able to report on that, but it will be voluntary. Our ministerial advisory group has recommended that over time that we move to a situation where the circular economy measures, you know, material use, waste, etc., would become part of the reporting system, understanding it wouldn't necessarily be in the mandatory at first. But I do think this is going to drive a lot of focus within businesses on circular economy opportunities. And so I'd say to all of you, if you're in a business that's going to be reporting, you need to be looking at the circular economy certainly down the track.
And as a board member,
yep,
there's nothing like a fiduciary duty to make you sit up and take notice and carry that through. And so that's been central, you know, when I was talking about the value chain, that includes your boards of directors. How do they come on board on the journey?
Yep. Okay, so thanks for that question. Another interesting question, got a lot of votes. What did you find as the most effective message that engaged the government with circular economy? Now, I'll leave that to any of you. Paul, you've tried to engage government over many years. What did you find in this recent time has been most effective?
Well, just to give a sense of context, I was on the National Waste Policy Committee back in 2018, 2019, and I tried to get it turned into a circular economy act, a circular economy policy. And with resounding negativity is probably the best way to describe it, I think. And even on the committee, I maybe had one person out of 12 supporting me. So all I managed to do is get some circular economy principles mentioned in the thing. So I think what's really happened is, I think the currency of circular economy has grown globally, and thanks to the work of Yanis and the EU and other countries have adopted circular economy policies. And so what that's really left us is, I think, that feeling that we're the odd person out. I mean, if 75% of the OECD have got a policy and we haven't, what's going on? Because that's our club. So I think that is being one of the things. But I think, a bit like Larry, it's an opportunity. And this is my take on why the circular economy, because I've been involved in lots of buzzwords over the years, everything from industrial symbiosis to biomimicry, none of which have ever caught on. I mean, not within their own little areas. And I even thought circular economy wouldn't catch on. I mean, this is probably 2015, 2016. I thought it's another one of those buzzwords. So my take on it is that humans love circles. That's why it's Knights of the Round Table. And we all are in economy. We're all in an economy of some description, even if you're in a subsistence economy. So we realize the economy provides our our want needs and sometimes our wants too often. So I think that is that interesting combination, is that we're not just talking about sustainability. So the amount of conversations I've had with business people who are not in any, because most of my conversations tend to be either sustainability people or waste and recycling focused people. And now I'm having conversations with people in the investment community, and not because of net zero or something, it's because they see there's an opportunity for a much more resource efficient, because everyone loves efficiency, I think, like at their core, even if they can be wasteful at times. They love the fact that there's an efficient system. Don't we all love to be able to go to a website, a government website, with three clicks and we'll be registered, not 20? And we always complain about it when it isn't that way. So I think there's that inherent desire for efficiency as well. In all of us. So anyway, that's just my take, is why they've become so engaged.
Yeah, Dom?
So for me, it was the conversations around what did we learn from COVID, supply chain disruption, and how can this be a vehicle to create more certainty within our supply chain? How do we create a circular certainty in Australia? So we look at what materials do we need. We look at how do we make those circular. We look at how do we improve manufacturing. We look at solar production, recycling here. And so all of those conversations that will just mean that we have more certainty into the future, I thought was really part of what made the government sit up.
My perspective is that one of the really good things that Tanya Plibersek did was engage the different ministers on their territory. So with Ed Husic, we engaged in Future Made in Australia, and we engaged with that lens. With Jim Chalmers, it was around productivity, and he has recently announced support for right to repair, put it in his frame, which is competitiveness, Australia's competitiveness, being able to compete in the international markets with our businesses, being able to be green and circular. So, and having productivity benefits from having common agreed standards was the other point he made. So Larry, I don't know whether you see any other...
Just the only other thing to add, I think also, so Tanya's a fabulous minister, and she, unlike many ministers, does turn up at the beginning of the meeting and stays all the way to the end of the meeting, and actually for every single meeting. She's amazing. But the other element was getting the startups in the room. So there's a lot of little companies around Australia that are actually got solutions to these types of problems. Getting them in front of the ministers and in front of the public servants who were writing the report, I think was a real eye-opener. Like, this is more real than people thought. And that kind of really helped them get more excited, especially when the startups weren't asking for money. They were saying, well, John's point at the beginning, hey, there's a startup in Victoria that's figured out how to do a particular type of recycling, but they can't go across the border to New South Wales because the regs are different. That's something the federal government can actually say, you know what, we can fix that. And it doesn't really cost anything to do it. So I think that really helped.
Great. Now, there's a number of people also have raised a really important question. How has First Nations wisdom been incorporated into the advisory group processes and insights? And this was a priority from the start. And as I think we mentioned, Professor Robin Quiggin, who is an Indigenous woman, was on the Circular Economy Ministerial Advisory Group. But importantly, we had some really good face-to-face stakeholder engagements with Indigenous people from around the country. And that was, for me, quite fascinating and enlightening. We haven't resolved our final recommendations, and I know Robin is just working through a few of them, but at the core will be a recognition that we have a lot to learn. I think that's absolutely cool, that we have a lot to learn from First Nations people and from caring to country. But also, it's important to recognise that as we transition to a more circular economy, there will be lots of opportunities, and there are Indigenous enterprises and Indigenous businesses who can make a very substantial contribution to the transition, and that will be part of it as well. So I would expect in our final report that the very central role of First Nations will be a core part of that. Moving on to some other questions. This is an interesting one. How do we turn around the lucky country narrative underpinning our reliance on commodities and primary industries? Larry, is that one I can start with you?
But I think I'll sound like I'm preaching if I go on about this anymore.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the more examples you have to show to make it real, the better. And I just happen to have one here. So Fortescue, like many mining companies, recycle about a tenth of a trillion litres of water every year. Tenth of a trillion. That's like a thousand million, million or something. Anyway, it's a big number. And it's really hard to filter that water because it's got minerals and all kinds of harsh elements in it. But Australia invented a way to make graphene, which is the world's hardest substance, to make graphene from soybeans. Now, graphene normally is made from, like, silicon in the semiconductor industry. It's made from toxic chemicals, all kinds of other stuff. This is actually grown in soybeans agriculturally. And it is fantastic filter for water, even when it's got really harsh chemicals and other things in it. That's an Australian invention that turned into an innovation here to solve a real world problem. We are the driest continent on the planet. So anything we can do to recycle and reuse our water is a massive win. So I think the more we talk about and celebrate the fact that actually we are solving these problems. Yep. Historically, okay, yeah, we're 72nd or 131st in the world, depending on which innovation metric you want to measure, but we're nowhere near the top 10. But we are the top 10 for science. We're solidly in the top 10 for science. We are amazing inventors, but we do have to turn invention to innovation and celebrate it.
Well, you're convinced, but convincing all, I mean, I think you've got, and you're working obviously with Fortescue, who are top innovators in a lot of this, but really, are we convincing the broader mass of our resources and extractive industry?
Oh, look, I think, so I'm on the board of a mining company, and, you know, it's great to be on the board of something because you can have a big influence on it. So Fortescue, for example, eliminated about 20,000 plastic containers a day that by sort of applying some of the lessons we'd learned at Syro to help the vendors of these products find different solutions that are more sustainable. But you've got to know it's possible in order to ask the question. So in order to ask the question, you've got to know what's possible and you've got to be able to actually come up with a solution. So running Syro was a fantastic exposure for me to understand what was possible and to have the resources to do the invention. But going to companies, and Fortescue was really forward-leaning. They really wanted to make change, as was NAB, as was Combank, but they didn't quite know how to do it. So the more we talk about the power of our science by demonstrating solutions, don't be afraid to pull a prop out of your pocket every so often to make it real. Australian industry used to never invest in Australian innovation, never. It was the most frustrating thing in my 30-year war against the innovation dilemma. But in the last decade, that's changed. You've seen many, many funds. Blackbird and MSV are just two, but there's many that actually invest in Australian science to try and turn it into solutions. So things are changing and we have an opportunity. We just got to grab hold of it and have the confidence to back ourselves. Otherwise, these inventions will do what they've always done. They'll go to the United States. They'll get funded there. They'll turn into companies there and we'll just buy the products, but we'll lose the opportunity. And I'd hate to see us have another decade of that.
Okay, I think it's last question. E-commerce platforms like Temu and Shein are major obstacles in this transition. Does banning unethical, non-circular products through platforms like these feature in your recommendations? Paul?
Not specifically, but what we're in our recommendations, what we're saying is that we want to have sustainable design guidelines, such as the EU, and therefore that actually acts as the barrier because, you know, picking on any specific thing is very difficult, but, you know, from a societal point of view, because everyone's got their own, you know, morals when it comes to what's good and what's bad. But if we have those criteria and the you've got to meet those criteria to come onto the market, that is a much more powerful way than just saying, oh, we're just going to ban this. We're just going to ban, because you could be you'd spend most of your life just filling in forms for bans. But if we do it that way, then that's how we've done it, through that design lens of saying, well, what is it? Let's create those guidelines like the EU, and that's great having that role model there. Hopefully might even be able to improve on them maybe, but if that's possible. But yeah, that's really our attitude to that.
Anyone else want to make a comment on that?
just on the previous question, we didn't hide the fact that we are a primary producer, and so there's a lot of material that goes into our economy and then out. And so how do we improve the material, but also shift from a materials-based economy over time into a higher value economy is part of that question, because, you know, as much as we have to use less stuff, that means we can invest in other things, education, art, music, community, events, experiences and so forth. And so it's not about thinking we need to tighten our belts. It's just to think about, you know, how do we buy a better belt so that we can enjoy life more.
Okay, well, that's a good way to finish up. We're being told we're over time, and I don't want to be recycled off the panel. So thank you to the panel for a great session.
So Paul, Dominic, Larry, thank you very much. What an inspirational panel. You didn't give us too many barriers. It was incredible.